Have you ever been sitting in your car? Maybe you're stuck in gridlock traffic on a Tuesday or something.
Oh, yeah, the absolute worst time.
Right. Or maybe you're just out walking the dog and suddenly you get hit with this profound aha moment.
Like a sudden clarity, right?
Exactly. You know, the exact kind I'm talking about. It's that deep, sudden sense of meaning that just totally shifts your perspective on your life.
Yeah, it feels like the ground beneath your feet just sort of settles.
Yes. Like it was totally unstable a second ago, and it just locked into a completely new, solid configuration.
It feels almost magical when it happens.
Spiritual, even. But what if that feeling wasn't just poetry?
Right.
What if it wasn't just a subjective, fleeting mood, but an actual structural change in the literal physics of your mind?
It is such a phenomenal question, and it's exactly the question we are going to explore today. Welcome back to the Deep Dive.
I'm so excited for this one.
Me too. We are looking at a single, incredibly dense, but frankly revolutionary source document today.
It really is.
It's a 2026 paper by C.F. Dietz. It's titled Meaning as Phase Change: Autonoesis, the Interpreter, and the Structure of Genuine Transformation.
Which is a mouthful.
It is a massive mouthful. But what blew my mind reading through this is that Dietz actually proves, mathematically, that this magic feeling we're talking about is a determinable physics event in the brain.
It's wild. So our goal for the next hour or so is to act as your guides through this complex framework. We want to figure out how we might actually, intentionally trigger that physics event in our own lives. I am so ready for this because the problem Dietz is trying to solve here has bothered me for years.
How so?
Well, historically, when we talk about this concept of meaning, there are basically two camps of thought, right? And they absolutely refuse to talk to each
They
other.
really do. They're totally siloed.
Yeah. So on one side, you have the philosophy and phenomenology camp.
Right, the existentialists.
Exactly. Think of people like Viktor Frankl writing about his harrowing experiences in a concentration camp in Man's Search for Meaning.
Such an incredible book.
It really is. And this camp is brilliant at describing what meaning feels like, why a human being desperately needs it to survive.
And the tragedy of what happens to us when it's gone.
Yes, exactly. But they don't have a mechanism. They can't point to a gear in your head and say, there it is. That's the meaning manufacturing organ.
They give us the soul of the experience, the human urgency of it, but they leave us entirely without the schematics.
Yep.
And then if you look at the exact opposite side of the spectrum, you have the neuroscience camp.
Right, the neuroscientists, people like Michael Gazzaniga or Antonio Damasio.
And they are in the lab looking at limbic valuations, somatic markers, neural correlates, all the hard biology.
Yeah, they can put you in an fMRI machine and map out exactly what your blood flow and brain activity look like when you push a button saying you feel a sense of meaning. But to me, they miss the soul. They can describe the electrical storms happening in the tissue, but they can't bridge that explanatory gap. They can't tell us what meaning actually is to the person experiencing it on the inside.
And this massive chasm between the two camps is exactly where Dietz steps in to build a bridge.
Thank goodness.
The core radical idea of this paper is a complete redefinition of our terms. Dietz says meaning is not an object you find out in the world, like a lost set of keys.
Or like a treasure hunt.
And it's not just a subjective overlay. It's not some, warm, fuzzy Instagram filter your brain places over otherwise neutral data just to make you feel better.
Right.
Dietz argues that meaning is a literal phase change. It is a mathematical, threshold-dependent reorganization of consciousness itself.
Okay, let me pause you there. Because when I hear phase change, my brain immediately goes to high school chemistry.
Naturally.
I think of water turning into ice or water boiling into steam. A specific temperature is reached, and the fundamental properties of the system completely reorganize, right? Like, ice behaves totally differently than steam. Are we saying the brain actually does that?
That is the exact analogy Dietz is invoking, but applied to dynamical systems in the brain.
Okay,
But
well.
before we can really understand how the mind reorganizes, like water turning to steam, we have to understand what pieces are actually on the board.
We need to learn the alphabet.
The specific alphabet Dietz uses to describe consciousness. The paper outlines a framework called the CCC framework.
CCC, what does that stand for?
It stands for Consciousness, Closure, and the Cosmos.
Okay, I do love a good blueprint. So let's go through this alphabet because it basically sets up everything else we're going to talk about today.
It does, it's foundational. So the first variable Dietz introduces is capital C.
Capital C.
Yes, this stands for irreducible presence. It's the raw, primitive fact that experience is happening at all.
Okay, and we really need to linger on this, right? Because Dietz treats capital C as an absolute primitive.
Without it, none of the rest of the theory works.
Right. Because think about a computer. If a computer makes a calculation error, or if a thermostat registers that a room is 10 degrees too cold, that's just a glitch.
It's just a data mismatch.
Yeah, it has no urgency. The thermostat does not suffer.
Exactly. But with capital C, this irreducible presence, an error becomes a felt structural gap.
It's the difference between a machine recording a temperature drop and a human being actually feeling the bitter, painful chill of winter.
That's a great way to put it. Capital C gives the entire system valence. It makes things matter.
Okay, so if capital C is the raw fact of feeling, then we move to the next variable, which is lowercase c.
Right. Lowercase c is localized consciousness.
So this is you and me talking right now.
Exactly. It's your specific daily thoughts, your memories, the narrative self running in your head, the fact that you remembered to buy milk this morning.
Right. So if capital C is the eternal background hum of awareness, lowercase c is the specific pop song playing on the radio right now.
That is a perfect distinction. So now we introduce the environment that this consciousness interacts with. And Dietz represents this by two horizons.
Okay, what's the first one?
Capital M. This is global openness. Yeah. This is the absolute unknown.
So everything outside of us.
Everything. It is the vast, infinite reality of the cosmos that exceeds every description, scientific model, or philosophy we could ever possibly build.
It's the terrifying, overwhelming everything.
Yes, it is. And nested within that terrifying everything is lowercase m.
Which is?
Your local horizon. That's the absolute edge of your personal understanding. It's the boundary where your localized consciousness, your lowercase c, hits its absolute limit.
Okay, so we've got the background hum, the pop song, the infinite universe, and my personal bubble.
Exactly. Which brings us to the two most active pieces on the board. And for you listening, these are the two you really need to remember for this whole theory to make sense.
Right. These are the heavy hitters.
Yes. They are CL and R.
Let's start with CL.
CL stands for closure. This is how your brain stabilizes all of that terrifying, overwhelming unknown into neat, understandable boxes.
Like categories.
Exactly. Closures are your rules, your identities, your political beliefs, your perceptual categories.
Yeah.
It's the mechanism that says, you know, that wooden thing with four legs is a chair. I know what to do with that.
Okay, got it. And in opposition to closure, we have R.
Right. The remainder.
The remainder. Yeah. So this is the mismatch. It's the anomalies, the data points that reality throws at you that just do not fit into your neat little CL boxes.
Precisely. It's the stuff that breaks your rules.
Okay. Let me try to build an analogy here to ground this, because otherwise it's just alphabet soup and I'll lose track.
Go for it.
Let's use a computer. If lowercase c is the software currently running on my computer, like my daily thoughts, then CL, the closures, are the folders I use to organize all my files.
I like this.
They keep everything neat, categorized, and safe. And R, the remainder, is that annoying error message you get when you download a weird file format that isn't recognized.
Yeah.
And it refuses to fit into any of your folders. It just sits on your desktop, taunting you.
It just clutters up the screen.
Exactly. And capital C, that irreducible presence we talked about first, that's the electricity running through the actual hardware.
That is a brilliant way to conceptualize it, and it perfectly highlights the engine of this entire theory.
Also,
because why does the electricity, capital C, matter so much? A computer without electricity doesn't care about the error message.
Right, it's just dead metal.
But because you have capital C, because you have valence and the capacity to feel, the remainder, that weird file that won't fit into your folders, creates a structural tension.
It makes it hurt.
Yes. It makes the gap between your folders and reality physically and emotionally felt.
Oh, wow.
Right. A theoretical machine with an infinite capacity to create folders and zero electricity to feel the error will just keep sorting files forever. It will never experience meaning.
Because it doesn't care.
Exactly. Phase change requires both the electricity to feel the friction and the eventual exhaustion of your folder system.
Which naturally pushes us into the mechanics of how this phase change actually triggers.
Mm.
Because, I mean, we've all had moments where we learn something new that doesn't fit our current folder.
Sure, every day.
But it doesn't always result in a profound spiritual awakening. Sometimes it's just annoying.
Mm.
So what happens when this remainder, this pile of unrecognized files on the desktop of our mind, starts really building up?
When it gets too heavy.
Yeah, when the pile of errors gets too big for our current folders to handle.
To explain this, Dietz introduces a state variable. It's represented by the Greek letter rho.
Okay, bringing in the Greek letters.
I know we are getting into a bit of math, but stick with it because it's actually deeply intuitive.
I'm with you.
Rho is simply a ratio. It is the amount of remainder you have accumulated divided by your maximum capacity to generate new closures to handle it.
Okay, so anomalies divided by my ability to explain them away.
Exactly. Think of it as a gauge on a high-pressure steam tank. As anomalies build up in your life that your worldview cannot explain, maybe your relationship fails inexplicably, or you face a health crisis.
Or you just read a piece of philosophy that shatters your previous assumptions.
Right. Your remainder increases. And if you can't build new folders fast enough to organize it, the pressure gauge rho starts rising.
And what happens when that pressure gauge maxes out? Like when rho hits a value of exactly one?
You are at the absolute boundary of your localized consciousness. And this is where Dietz pulls a concept from dynamical systems theory called the saddle node bifurcation.
Okay, hold on.
I know.
Saddle node bifurcation sounds like a physics textbook threw up on a math test. You are going to have to translate that for me. What does that actually look like in the brain?
Fair enough. Imagine a physical landscape with deep valleys and high hills.
Okay, I picture it.
Your current worldview, your current set of folders and closures, is a very deep valley. In physics, we call this an attractor basin.
Attractor basin. Got it.
Imagine your mind is a marble resting at the bottom of that deep valley. It's stable. It's comfortable. It takes a lot of energy to push the marble up the hill, so it usually just stays put.
That is me living my normal everyday life, eating cereal, going to work.
Exactly. But then the remainder starts accumulating. The weird files keep dropping on your desktop.
Right. Reality is acting up.
Yes. And as reality continually refuses to fit into your models, the math of the closure objective actually begins to deform the physical landscape.
Wait, really?
Yes. The accumulation of unresolvable errors literally pushes the floor of the valley up. The basin becomes progressively shallower. The hills around you shrink.
So my comfortable worldview is literally flattening out. It's becoming less stable.
Exactly. And at the exact mathematical point of the saddle node bifurcation, when your pressure gauge, Bray, exceeds one, the valve completely flattens out and annihilates.
Just disappears.
It ceases to be a mathematically stable place for your mind to rest. The marble cannot stay there.
Oh, wow. So where does it go?
It is forced, deterministically, to roll down a steep, newly formed gradient into a completely new, much deeper valley. It reorganizes into a new attractor basin.
Wait, wait, wait. I need to push back on this word deterministically.
Okay, good.
Because this sounds wildly deterministic.
Yeah.
Are you saying that meaning isn't a choice? Like, if my valley flattens out, does my brain just shake the marble around randomly until it accidentally lands in a new worldview? Is finding meaning just a lucky roll of the neurological dice?
Dietz is incredibly firm on this point, and it's a major departure from how we usually think about personal growth. It is absolutely not random.
It's not.
No. It is not stochastic or probabilistic basin hopping. It is what physicists call deterministic free energy gradient descent.
You keep using these massive terms. Break that down for me. If it's not random, what is guiding the marble?
The brain naturally, biologically, seeks to minimize uncertainty. In neuroscience, particularly in the work of Carl Friston, this uncertainty is called free energy.
And the brain hates free energy.
It despises it. It wants predictability. So when your old valley collapses, the system doesn't randomly vibrate, and it also doesn't teleologically seek, meaning like a heat-seeking missile looking for a profound truth.
It doesn't know where it's going.
Exactly. Instead, it operates exactly like water flowing downhill. The mind deterministically flows down the steepest available path to reduce that overwhelming, painful uncertainty.
And the new valley it lands in.
Is a new, broader, more comprehensive set of closures. That descent, that sudden reorganization into a deeper understanding, is the experience of meaning.
It is a structural inevitability when the conditions the pressure gauge are met.
Exactly.
Okay, that actually makes a terrifying amount of sense. It's gravity for the mind.
Gravity for the mind. I love that.
But I want to draw a really bright line here, because Dietz makes a massive distinction between this true phase change and something called Bayesian updating.
Yes, this is a crucial distinction.
Yeah, because, look, you and I learn new things all the time, right? I read a book yesterday. I updated my understanding of the world. But learning a new fact doesn't feel like a profound spiritual awakening. It just feels like learning.
And that distinction is vital. Bayesian updating is just adding a new data point to an existing folder.
Like dropping a new file in.
Right. If you learn a new vocabulary word, or you learn that the capital of Australia is Canberra, not Sydney, you haven't shattered your understanding of the universe.
Right. I'm not weeping with joy over Canberra.
Exactly. You just added a file. The grammar of your folders, the fundamental rules for how you organize reality, remains totally unchanged. The valley you are resting in is still the exact same valley.
But a phase change. That's when the grammar of the folders themselves must completely rewrite.
The old filing system is annihilated.
And Dietz uses a classic visual example here that I think perfectly illustrates the difference. It's the duck-rabbit illusion.
Oh, perfect example.
For anyone listening, you've definitely seen this image. It's a simple line drawing that, depending on how you look at it, looks like a duck facing left or a rabbit facing right.
It's the simplest example of a phase change. Think about what happens when you look at the duck rabbit. The photons bouncing off the page and hitting your retina are exactly the same.
The raw data hasn't changed by a single pixel.
Not one. But suddenly, your brain reorganizes its identity criteria. The fundamental grammar of your perception snaps.
What were duckbills instantaneously become rabbit ears.
Yes. You didn't just add a feather to your concept of a duck. Your entire perceptual framework underwent a structural reorganization.
That snap, that instant reorganization where the duck is completely gone and the rabbit exists, that is what Dietz means by a phase change.
Right.
Albeit a very small perceptual one.
Right. It's a micro version of it.
But here is the question that's been bothering me. If this is a natural deterministic process, if the mind operates like water naturally flowing downhill when the valley collapses, why is genuine meaning sometimes so incredibly hard to find?
It's the million-dollar question.
Right. Why are there millions of people walking around feeling completely alienated and meaningless? Especially, and Dietz points this out in a way that stung a bit, for highly intelligent, highly educated people.
This is where the paper gets a bit dark.
Oh, boy.
Because it forces us to confront the architecture of our own intelligence. To understand why meaning is so evasive, we have to look at a mechanism Michael Gazzaniga discovered called the left brain interpreter.
This is honestly one of the most fascinating and disturbing concepts in all of neuroscience.
It really is.
For those who aren't familiar, Gazzaniga did his most famous work studying split brain patients, right?
Yes, back in the 60s and 70s.
These were people who had the corpus callosum, which is the thick bundle of nerve fibers connecting the left and right hemispheres of the brain, surgically severed. Usually as a last resort treatment for severe epilepsy.
Right. So post-surgery, their left hemisphere and right hemisphere literally could not communicate with each other. They were entirely isolated.
And because language production is almost always localized in the left hemisphere, Gazzaniga realized he could run some incredibly revealing experiments.
He could flash an image to the patient's left eye, which wires exclusively to the silent right hemisphere.
Right.
And the speaking left hemisphere would have absolutely no idea what the right hemisphere just saw.
And Dietz specifically points to an experiment Gazzaniga ran that is often called the chicken shed experiment.
Huh.
I need you to walk us through this because the implications of this for our daily lives were wild.
It really is paradigm shifting. So in this experiment, Gazzaniga sat a split brain patient in front of a screen. He showed the patient's right eye, which wires to the speaking left hemisphere, a picture of a chicken claw.
Okay, left brain sees a chicken claw.
At the exact same time, he showed the left eye, which wires to the silent right hemisphere, a picture of a snowy winter landscape.
Right brain sees snow.
Then he presented the patient with a table full of random pictures and asked them to point with both hands to the pictures that matched what they just saw on the screen.
Okay, let's track the biology here. The right hand is controlled by the left brain, which saw the chicken claw. So the right hand points to a picture of a chicken. That makes total sense.
Perfectly logical.
And the left hand is controlled by the right brain, which saw the snowstorm. So the left hand points to a picture of a snow shovel. Again, perfectly logical based on the visual inputs.
Exactly. Both hemispheres process their separate data perfectly. But then Gazzaniga does the crucial thing.
The trick.
He asks the patient, meaning he is forcing the speaking left hemisphere to answer, why did your left hand just point to the shovel?
Oh, man.
Now, remember, the physical reality here. The left hemisphere did not see the snowstorm. It is physically impossible for it to know why the left hand pointed to the shovel.
So it is faced with a massive, inexplicable anomaly, a remainder.
Yes. Its local horizon has been breached. The weird file is on the desktop. The pressure gauge row is spiking rapidly toward one because the left brain has absolutely no closure for this event.
And logically, you would expect the patient to say, you know, I have no idea why my left hand did that. It moved on its own.
That would be the truthful response to the unknown.
But rather than sitting with that unknown, rather than letting the valley collapse and the saddle node bifurcation happen, what does the left brain do?
It instantly, seamlessly fabricates a lie.
It's so crazy.
The patient looked at Gazzaniga and said, with total, unblinking confidence, "Oh, that's easy. The chicken claw goes with the chicken, and you need a shovel to clean out the chicken shed."
The brain just made it up. It hallucinated a logical bridge, completely out of thin air, just to avoid the terror of the unknown.
Yeah.
And the patient believed it.
Completely believed it. It wasn't a conscious deception. And this is what Deitz calls false closure.
False closure.
The interpreter mechanism in our left hemisphere absolutely hates unresolved gaps. It views a high row value as a threat to its existence. So it frantically generates narratives, little band-aids to close the gaps.
To keep the pressure down.
Yes. It actively prevents the saddle node annihilation by creating a localized, highly defensive explanation. It tells a story to keep the marble in the current valley.
And Dietz doesn't just leave this as a cool anecdote, right? He gives us a mathematical formula to act as a literal lie detector for our own false closures.
He does. It's called the complexity stability ratio.
Represented by the Greek letter eta. So let me see if I have this math right. Eta equals the change in remainder divided by the change in complexity.
You have the variables, but it's the relationship between them that's key. It's delta R over delta CL.
Okay, delta R over delta CL.
Right. The change in your unresolved anomalies divided by the amount of complex rules you had to invent to explain them.
Okay, walk me through a real-world example of this.
Yeah.
Because I want to know if I'm walking around cleaning out chicken sheds in my old life.
We all are, to some extent.
If my 80 is positive, does that mean I am basically just building conspiracy theories?
That is precisely what a positive eta means. Let's look at the math in a real-world scenario. Say you go through a terrible breakup that you didn't see coming.
Ouch.
That's a massive anomaly, a huge spike in remainder. Now, you could let that break your models, let the valley collapse, and undergo a painful phase change about your own flaws and the nature of relationships.
But that hurts. That's a lot of free energy.
Exactly. So instead, your internal interpreter goes to work. You invent a highly complex narrative. You say, my ex is actually a covert narcissist, their friends brainwashed them, society is set up to ruin relationships, and astrology predicted this anyway.
I'm laughing because it's too real. I've definitely done a version of this.
We all have. But look at what happened mathematically. Your complexity, the amount of convoluted rules you had to invent, went way up.
Right.
But your actual remainder, your deep underlying confusion and pain, didn't really go down. You just covered it up.
So a large increase in complexity divided by a negligible decrease in remainder yields a positive eta.
Yes. You are just adding auxiliary hypotheses to protect your fragile worldview from reality. You are cleaning the chicken shed. You are surviving, but you are not experiencing meaning.
Wow. So by contrast, a genuine insight, a real phase change, would have a negative eta.
Exactly.
The complexity might go up slightly, like maybe you adopt one new overarching philosophy, but it pays for itself by massively, radically reducing the amount of unexplained anomalies across the board.
Everything suddenly makes sense.
To go back to the duck rabbit, the duck becomes a rabbit. And you don't need 20 new complicated rules to explain why the duck's bill suddenly looks furry and weird. It's just ears now.
One simple closure explains the whole picture.
That is a perfect explanation. A negative eta is the mathematical signature of elegance.
It is. And this exact dynamic leads to what I consider the most challenging part of Dietz's paper. He calls it the sophistication trap.
Oh, I felt personally attacked by this section.
I think anyone who enjoys learning feels a bit called out by it.
Seriously.
The sophistication trap explains why highly intelligent, high repertoire individuals, you know, the very people who listen to deep dives, who read nonfiction, who overanalyze their lives, can actually struggle the most with finding meaning.
Wait, really? The most.
Yes. Because you are smart, your internal interpreter has a massive, highly articulate vocabulary. You are incredibly good at generating complex, positive, eta defensive closures.
I feel so seen right now, and not in a good way. If I encounter a deep existential void or a profound failure, I don't just sit there and let my worldview collapse. That's terrifying.
Of course it is.
Instead, I immediately go to a bookstore. I buy 3 books on Stoic philosophy. I rationalize my feelings through a sociological lens. I listen to a podcast about the neuroscience of trauma. And I build this elaborate, impenetrable intellectual fortress for all my anxiety.
And look at what you've achieved by doing that. You have successfully logicked your way out of the saddle node annihilation.
My IT guy just wrote a brilliant piece of code to rename all my error files so they look like normal folders, stopping the system from crashing.
Yes. You prevent the pressure gauge from hitting one. You successfully defend your current attractor basin. But by doing so, you structurally bar yourself from the genuine phase change of meaning. Your sheer cognitive ability, your love of learning, becomes the very prison that keeps you trapped in a shallow valley.
That is so incredibly dark. It means my intelligence is actively working against my spiritual well-being.
In a structural sense, yes.
So if being smart and having a lot of mental frameworks actually traps us in these false closures, how do we ever break out?
It's the necessary next step.
Like, if my IT guy is too good at his job, how do I actually reach that threshold where the pressure hits one, the system crashes, and genuine meaning gets to happen? Dietz doesn't just leave us hanging, right?
No, he doesn't. Dietz defines the formal threshold for this event as TCOMF, the confabulation threshold.
The point where we can't lie anymore.
Exactly. This is the point where your interpreter simply cannot lie fast enough to cover the gaps. We have to exceed it. And the three pathways he outlines to get there are fascinating.
Let's hear them.
The first pathway is the most brutal and, frankly, the most common historically. It's natural exhaustion.
This is when life just completely breaks you.
Put simply, yes. This is when the empirical structure you encounter in reality is so overwhelming, so devastating, or so undeniably complex that you simply run out of explanations. Your models shatter under the sheer weight of reality.
Give me an example of this. Like, what does that look like?
In the lab, the split-brain patient will naturally exhaust their explanations if Gazzaniga pushes them hard enough, brings in witnesses, and ruthlessly reveals the trick of the experiment. Eventually, the left brain has to admit defeat.
Okay, but in real life?
In real life, this is often the role of profound grief, a terminal diagnosis, or a massive catastrophic crisis. A parent losing a child, for instance.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
No amount of reading stoicism or inventing chicken shed stories can close that gap. The anomaly is too massive. Your folder system is naturally violently exhausted, row hits one, and the phase change is forced upon you.
It is agonizing, but it often results in a completely transformed worldview.
Yes, exactly.
Okay, but as a general life strategy, we probably don't want to rely on catastrophic trauma to find meaning.
Definitely not recommended.
Right. Which brings us to pathway two, which is a bit more proactive. Deliberate repertoire reduction.
This pathway is where you intentionally lower your capacity to generate closures. If you can't increase the anomalies to break the threshold, you lower the threshold itself.
You dumb yourself down?
Sort of. You partially suspend your CL generating mechanisms through extreme practices or harsh physical circumstances.
So this would be things like vision quests, intense fasting, extreme endurance sports like ultramarathons, or even sensory deprivation tanks.
Precisely. Think about what happens during a five-day water fast or at mile 80 of an ultramarathon. Your brain is starved of glucose.
You're running on fumes?
The prefrontal cortex, which houses a lot of that interpreter machinery, starts to downregulate. You are deliberately putting your brain in a state where its physical ability to generate those clever intellectual defensive band-aids is severely compromised.
The IT guy is asleep at the desk.
Yes. By lowering your defenses, ordinary anomalies suddenly feel massive. Row hits one much faster, and a phase change can happen organically without needing a tragedy to trigger it.
That makes biological sense, but I'm going to be honest, I'm not really an ultramarathon guy.
Very fair.
So I am very thankful for Pathway 3, which Dietz frames as the ultimate hack for the learner profile, the intellectual escape hatch from the sophistication trap.
Yes, metacognitive override.
Metacognitive override. This is where Dietz makes a brilliant theoretical move that solves a major problem in cognitive science, doesn't he?
He really does. Metacognitive override is the creation of a higher order closure, what he calls a meta CL. And this meta folder has only one foundational grammatical rule.
Which is?
Observe reality without applying any lower order closures.
Wait, hold on. Let me push back on this because this sounds like a trap.
Go on.
If I'm using my mind to tell my mind to stop making closures, isn't that just what philosophers call the homunculus problem? Like, am I just pretending there's a little tiny person sitting inside my head pulling levers, telling the rest of the brain to shut up? Psychologists hate the homunculus problem because it just kicks the can down the road. Who is controlling the little man?
You are exactly right to call that out, and Dietz anticipates this critique perfectly. The triumph of this framework is that it remains strictly monistic.
Meaning just one system.
Right. There is no little man in the head. There is no mystical outside agent separate from your brain. Dietz argues that the act of withholding closure is, mathematically and structurally, itself a closure.
Okay, my brain just did a little flip. Let me make sure I'm tracking this. Withholding a folder is just a different kind of folder.
Yes. It's a cultivated mental habit, not a mystical state.
Oh, I see.
When you practice mindfulness meditation or when you engage in rigorous, true Socratic dialogue, you aren't doing magic. You aren't stepping outside of your brain. You are practically, repeatedly training this meta-CL.
You are building a structural habit.
Yes, a specific neural pathway that says, when the interpreter starts frantically generating a chicken shed story to explain my anxiety, I am going to watch it happen, but I am not going to adopt it as a stable belief.
So, using the computer analogy, I write a script that runs in the background. And whenever the IT guy tries to rename an error file to hide it, the script just tags it as suspicious and leaves it on the desktop.
I love that. Yes.
I just let the false closure float by as a lowercase c, a localized passing thought, without stabilizing it into a firm, load-bearing CL.
That is a flawless extension of the analogy. And by running that script, by doing that metacognitive override, you intentionally keep your effective repertoire near zero.
You refuse to clean the chicken shed.
Exactly. Because you are not bleeding off the pressure with false stories, the pressure beige triggercator is allowed to naturally rise to one without interference.
The phase change is permitted to happen on its own.
You don't have to wait for a tragedy, and you don't have to starve yourself in the desert. You voluntarily suspend your defenses.
Okay, so let's say we actually pull this off. We sit on the meditation cushion for years, or we go through a deep Socratic inquiry with a great therapist, or life just hits us with something beautiful and unexplainable, and we finally let that phase change happen.
The valley annihilates, the marble drops into a deeper basin.
Right. What does that actually look like for the person experiencing it? Because Dietz lays out five distinct depths of phase change. It's not just a one-size-fits-all enlightenment, right?
Far from it. The depth of the reorganization entirely depends on how deep the saddle node was reached, like how fundamental the collapsing valley was to your core identity.
Okay, let's walk through the five levels.
Level one is recognition. This is the narrowest scope of phase change.
That's our duck rabbit from earlier, the perceptual shift.
Right. Your visual grammar reorganizes. You see the rabbit instead of the duck, but you haven't fundamentally changed who you are as a human being.
Exactly. It's a localized structural shift. What's next?
Then we move down to level two, which is reframing. The clinical correlate here is successful cognitive behavioral therapy, or a significant narrative shift in how you view your past.
So for you listening, this is that moment in therapy where you don't just temporarily change your mood.
Mm-hmm.
You realize your entire core belief was a bad mathematical model.
Right. The saddle node is reached at the level of a load-bearing belief. You don't just see an image differently. You see a vital situation differently.
Like maybe changing how you see your childhood.
Exactly. The old grammar of, say, I am inherently a failure because my parents criticized me, reorganizes into something broader and more generative. Like, my parents were flawed people projecting their anxiety onto me, and I'm actually highly capable.
It's a structural rewrite.
The previous negative grammar becomes permanently unavailable in the same way. You can remember thinking it, but you can't believe it anymore.
That brings us to level three, which is meaning. This is where the paper gets profoundly moving, honestly. Dietz says this level involves reorganizing what you were actually living for.
Yes. The clinical correlates here are Viktor Frankl's logotherapy, the experience of falling deeply, permanently in love, or encountering a piece of transformative art that just shatters your previous worldview.
Big stuff.
The saddle node here is reached at the level of your orientation closure, the very folders that dictate your purpose in the cosmos. And this is where Dietz does something absolutely incredible with a medical phenomenon we all know, the placebo effect.
Oh, man. I was hoping we would get to this because I read this section three times. It is so brilliant.
It really is a paradigm shift.
Because we all know the standard definition of placebo, right?
Mm-hmm.
You go to the doctor, they give you a sugar pill, but they tell you it's a powerful painkiller. Your brain expects to get better, so it releases some dopamine and endogenous opioids, and you actually feel a bit better.
Right, expectancy theory. It's a trick.
But Dietz completely reframes this mechanism.
He does, by pointing to the recent, highly controversial work of researchers like Ted Kapchuk and Fabrizio Benedetti, specifically their work on open-label placebos.
Open-label placebos. Break that down.
Kapchuk ran studies where he gave patients with severe irritable bowel syndrome or chronic back pain a bottle of pills. But here's the catch. The bottle literally had the word placebo printed on the label.
So they knew it was fake.
The doctors explicitly told the patients, these are sugar pills. They have absolutely no active medication in them. We are giving you a fake pill. And yet, after a few weeks, the patients got significantly, measurably better.
Which completely blows up expectancy theory.
Completely.
If you know it's a fake pill, you shouldn't expect it to work. There should be no dopamine release based on a trick, because you know the trick. So why in the world does it work?
Dietz argues that placebos don't just work because of localized neurochemical dopamine hits. A powerful medical ritual, even an honest, open-label one, can actually force the patient into a level 3 phase change.
Think about the pathways we just discussed, right?
Exactly. The patient is suffering from chronic pain. They have been to 10 doctors. They have naturally exhausted all their defensive frameworks and intellectual closures around their illness.
They are at rock bottom. Ro is hovering right at 1.
They are primed for a collapse of the valley. And then they enter a clinical relationship that is genuine. The care and attention of the doctor are real, even if the pill is fake. The ritual of taking the pill every day is real.
So the ritual itself triggers it.
So faced with the ritual of healing and the massive gap between their current suffering and the strange possibility of relief offered by this doctor, their brain finally reaches the saddle node. The I am an incurably sick person identity basin annihilates.
They literally reorganize their domain of significance.
Yes. The physical healing that follows is the downstream result of a structural phase change in their consciousness, not just a trick of expectancy.
It's a breathtaking application of the math. It elevates the placebo from a medical parlor trick to a fundamental mechanism of human transformation.
It's beautiful. Yeah. But the depths go even further. Level 4 is dissolution.
Dissolution? What dissolves?
The self model itself is suspended. The autonoetic interpreter, that left brain IT guy generating the false closures, is taken completely offline.
The clinical correlates here are high-dose psychedelics, near-death experiences, or the very deepest stages of profound grief. We often call it ego death, right?
Yes. The pressure gauge hits infinity because the very mechanism that manages the pressure has temporarily vanished. The boundary between the localized lowercase c and the infinite cosmos, capital M, dissolves.
And finally, Level 5, transformation. Dietz notes this is incredibly rare.
Exceedingly rare.
The saddle node is reached permanently and comprehensively at the level of your total closure grammar. The entire operating system of your mind is rewritten from the ground up. And crucially, the old worldview can literally never reconstitute.
It's a permanent one-way trip.
Historical religious conversions, like Paul on the road to Damascus, or the most profound once-in-a-lifetime outcomes in deep, years-long psychotherapy live here. The ADA, that lie detector formula, is persistently negative across all domains of your life.
You stop needing to lie to yourself entirely. It is the ultimate reorganization of the human system.
Okay, so we've talked about how meaning happens. It's a physics event, a basin switching, a phase change driven by accumulating errors.
Right.
But here's the thing that always trips me up in my own life. How does it stick?
That is the big question.
We've all had those moments at 2 a.m., maybe you're staring at the stars or reading a profound quote or having a deep conversation, where you feel that level 3 or level 4 shift. Everything makes total sense. You feel connected to the universe.
And then
you wake up on Tuesday morning, someone cuts you off in traffic, and you are just annoyed and petty again. Why do some profound moments fade like a dream while others actually change our lives forever?
This is a vital question, and it's the crucial distinction Dietz makes in Section 6, distinguishing the mere occurrence of meaning from the retention of meaning over time.
Occurrence versus retention.
To understand how meaning actually sticks, Dietz brings in the pioneering work of memory researcher Endel Tolving, specifically his concept of autonoesis.
Autonoesis, which roughly translates to mental time travel.
Precisely. Autonosis is your specific cognitive capacity for self-placement across time. It is your ability to encode a subjective, episodic memory that says, I am the exact same person who experienced that profound moment yesterday, and I will be that same person tomorrow.
Dietz argues that autonoesis is the integration scaffold.
Yes.
It's not required to have a phase change in the present moment, but it is absolutely biologically required to hold a phase change.
You need the scaffold to encode it as a permanent before and after in the narrative story of who you are. Without it, the phase change happens, but it washes away.
And to ground this in hard neuroscience, Dietz outlines three distinct temporal signatures for how this process unfolds in the brain.
This is where we see the transition from an instantaneous physics event to a lasting psychological trait.
Okay, let's break down those three signatures because I want to know exactly what is happening in my head when I have an aha moment. Signature one is incredibly fast. We are talking milliseconds.
Milliseconds. This is the saddle node event itself, the exact mathematical moment the basin annihilates and the marble drops.
And what's the neural marker for that?
The specific neural marker here is a gamma band frequency burst localized in the right anterior temporal lobe of the brain.
Wow.
It's the literal electrical flash of the insight. It's lightning fast, and it occurs before you even have words for what just happened.
Signature two is a bit slower, 5 to 10 seconds after the flash.
This is narrative consolidation. Your internal interpreter, the left brain storyteller, is frantically trying to catch up to the massive phase change that just happened in the right hemisphere.
It's weaving the first draft of the story to explain the new landscape you just landed in.
Exactly. Now, if you are just confabulating, if you are building a false closure, like the chicken shed, the process stops here.
You tell the lie, the dissonance resolves, the pressure drops, and you go back to normal. The meaning doesn't stick because it wasn't real.
But if it's a genuine phase change and you don't lie to yourself.
Then you enter signature three, which is autonoetic integration. This takes variable time, hours, maybe days, often requiring multiple sleep cycles. This relies on massive hippocampal cortical reactivation.
It's a heavy biological lift.
Unpack that biology for us. What is the hippocampus actually doing during this time?
During rest, and especially during slow wave sleep, your hippocampus acts like a projector. It replays the neural firing patterns of that profound moment over and over again, broadcasting them up into the cerebral cortex.
It is physically, chemically wiring the new configuration into the long-term storage of your brain.
Yes. It is physically building the autonoetic scaffold to hold the new reality across time. To use your computer analogy, signature one is the software crashing and rebooting. Signature three is the hard drive slowly reformatting to ensure it boots up the new way tomorrow.
Without this third signature, the meeting happened, but it doesn't stick.
Right. And this biological reality brings us to one of the most poignant and empathetic parts of the whole paper.
The clinical application.
Dietz talks about an application called CHAMPA, the Cognitive Home Assessment and Monitoring Platform. It's a clinical application of this theory, and Dietz specifically discusses how this applies to patients suffering from severe cognitive decline, like Alzheimer's disease.
It is profoundly moving, and it completely shifts how we should think about dementia care.
In diseases like Alzheimer's, the capacity for autonoesis, that signature three hippocampal integration, the ability to build the scaffold, degrades heavily and early.
But the capacity for irreducible presence, capital C, the ability to feel and experience valence, remains intact almost to the very end.
Meaning the patient loses the scaffold. They lose the hard drive. They lose the ability to hold the phase change across time. But
if their right anterior temporal lobe is still functioning, they can still experience the saddle node bifurcation.
Exactly.
They can still have the millisecond burst of genuine insight.
This is why you see those incredible videos of a patient with advanced cognitive decline listening to a piece of music from their childhood or holding a loved one's hand, and suddenly they light up.
They become totally lucid.
In that moment, they are organically exhausting their limited closures. They are undergoing a genuine level three phase change. The meaning they experience in that specific moment is structurally, mathematically, and authentically real.
That gives me chills.
The fact that their hippocampus cannot record it, the fact that they might not remember it 10 minutes later, does absolutely nothing to negate the physics of the transformation that just occurred in their consciousness.
I want you listening to really hear that, especially if you have a loved one going through cognitive decline. Meaning is a real-time physics event. It is not just a memory.
It's an event in the present tense.
Even if someone cannot remember yesterday, the profound connection they feel in a given moment is structurally real. That is both a tragedy, because they can't hold it, but it is also an incredible, beautiful comfort regarding the dignity of the human experience at every single stage of life.
It completely reframes clinical interaction. The goal of a caregiver isn't always to build a memory, because sometimes you can't. Sometimes the highest goal is simply to facilitate the conditions for a phase change in the present tense, to provide the music, the touch, the safety that allows the valley to collapse into meaning for just a few seconds.
Okay, we have covered an immense amount of ground today. We have gone from the philosophy of Viktor Frankl to the math of dynamical systems.
It's been a journey.
Let's do a quick recap of the journey we've taken through Dietz's mind. We started by dismantling the old divide between poetry and brain scans. Meaning isn't a fairy tale, and it's not just a squirt of dopamine.
Right.
It is a saddle node bifurcation. It happens when the anomalies of life, the remainder, the files that won't fit the folders, build up so much that your current worldview literally collapses under the mathematical weight of its own inadequacy.
And we learned that to get there, we often have to fight our own intelligence. We have to override the brain's internal interpreter, that left brain mechanism that desperately wants to invent a chicken shed story to save us from the terror of the unknown.
We have to use metacognitive override to let the pressure build, to let the old models annihilate, so we can deterministically flow into a deeper, more generative valley.
Beautifully summarized.
But I want to leave you with a final provocative thought. Something from the very end of Dietz's paper that we haven't fully explored yet, but that I want you to mull over as you go about the rest of your day.
Yes, the causal non-reducibility section.
Right, a concept Dietz calls causal non-reducibility, or causal emergence.
This is the formal threshold requirement for capital C, the irreducible potence. The formula is EI macro is greater than EI micro.
And what that formula means is breathtaking. Dietz argues that for this entire meaning-making system to work, for you to be able to feel a lack of meaning, for capital C, that painful valence, to even exist, your system must have causal emergence.
It's essential.
This means that the macro level version of you, the whole unified conscious person listening to this deep dive right now, literally has more causal power over the future than the sum of your microscopic neurons.
It is the ultimate mathematical rejection of strict biological determinism. You are not just a collection of cells following physics.
Exactly. I asked earlier if this was all just deterministic, if we were just lucky dice rolls. Dietz's answer is that you are not just atoms bouncing around. You are not a passive victim of information overload or your brain's chemistry.
No, you are causally emergent.
According to the literal physics of consciousness laid out in this paper, the very fact that you can feel a lack of meaning, the fact that the error message hurts you, proves mathematically that you are a whole, causally unified self.
The pain of meaninglessness is the mathematical proof that you have agency and that you are capable of genuine transformation.
If you were just a machine, the errors wouldn't matter. The thermostat doesn't cry. The valence of the gap, the fact that you suffer when things don't make sense, is the absolute proof of your emergence as a conscious being.
It's an incredibly empowering way to view our own suffering.
It really is. So as you go about your day today, maybe you're heading into a meeting or making dinner, I want you to just notice your own brain's interpreter at work.
Watch it try to build those stories?
Exactly.
Yeah.
Watch how quickly it tries to slap a Band-Aid over the things you don't understand. Watch it build those false closures and clean the chicken shed. And maybe, just for a moment, try running that metacognitive script.
Suspend the folders.
Let the unknown just sit there on the desktop. Because on the other side of that collapsing valley is the exact mechanism of genuine meaning. Thank you for taking this deep dive with us. We'll see you next time.